Welcome to Special Sauce 2.0, SiriusXM's podcast about food and life, now with an expanded menu. Every week on Special Sauce, we begin with Ask Kenji, where Kenji Lopez-Alt, SiriusXM's chief culinary consultant, gives the definitive answer to the question of the week that a Sirius eater like you has sent us. After Ask Kenji, a conversation with our guest, today my old friend, cookbook author, and food stylist to the stars, Susan Spungen, whose new book is Open Kitchen, Inspired Food for Casual Gathering, is back with us. First up, our chief culinary consultant, author of The Food Lab, Kenji Lopez-Alt. David Gregg has the question of the week. Ree's smash burgers, something close to both of our hearts. I've made them several times now. I have a carbon steel griddle on my gas grill outside. I get it real hot. Start there. First batch has a great crust. Second set of smash burgers, the temperature cools and fat pools, and I get no crust but gray meat. So both times I've moved grilling inside to a grill pan flat side on my stove. The heat stays consistent, but I smoke my house up. Question, is it possible to do outside on a grill with carbon steel pan, or is the heat on a grill too far from the pan? Is there a temperature of the cooking surface I should look for with an infraspot thermometer?
Okay. So let's I think we can work.
Yeah, we got to break this down here.
Yeah, so the last question was, is there a surface temperature he should be looking for on a pan to cook a burger? The answer is no, and it's because temperature is a measurement that's entirely dependent on the medium that you're measuring. So a stainless steel pan at one temperature is going to cook differently from a carbon steel pan at the same temperature, which will cook differently from an aluminum pan at the same temperature, which will cook differently from cast iron at the same temperature. So surface temperature is only really useful if you're talking about the exact same material and the sort of the same thickness every time. So the answer is yes. The surface temperature you should be looking for is, assuming you're using the same pan every time, use the temperature that worked well for you the last time and look for that temperature. But there's no magic number that I can give you that's going to apply to your pan. If you want to feel like an illustration of this, you know, there's that old thing where if you stand with bare feet on a floor that has a rug over tile, and you put one foot on the tile and one foot on the rug, the foot on the rug feels much warmer, even though those two things are actually the same temperature. They're both ambient room temperature. The tile feels much cooler than the rug, which feels warmer, and that's just because of the way they conduct heat and because of their specific heat capacity and all these other things that affect the way heat is transferred, even given the same exact temperature. So if we move back from there, the question was, can you put a carbon steel pan on top of an outdoor grill and get it hot enough to sear burgers
right in,
or is the flame too far away? That's really a question. I mean, I can't answer that question. It depends on your grill. It depends on your setup. So the answer is you're going to have to try it. Probably yes, you're going to be fine. Like, you know, I've done that. Probably yes, you'll be able to get it plenty hot if you build a big fire out of coal. If you've got, you know, like a weaker gas burner, then probably not. But if you've got any kind of coal fire, you know, or wood fired grill, you can always build the fire higher and higher and higher to as high as you want. But the answer to that, again, is you're just going to have to try it and see. Now, the very first question, I think, was that when he's cooking burgers, the first burgers come out well.
And then the second set come out gray.
Yeah. The reason that's happening, and I think he even said it, is because the pan cools down.
Right.
So really the only answer is you got to wait for your pan to heat back up again.
Right. It's just time.
It's time. You know, wipe it out, make sure there's nothing in there that's going to burn, and just wait for it to heat back up again. If you're having this trouble outside, then you probably just need some more coal and some more time. If you're having the trouble inside, yeah, it's just a matter of more time. And if your apartment's smoking out when you're cooking burgers, that just means you're doing it right. There's no way you can sear a steak or a burger or anything that requires high heat cooking without creating smoke. You know,
yeah.
Dave Arnold always calls smoke detectors cooking detectors.
Right. So I think, can we give David Gregg the advice is that he just needs to cool out? No, I'm sorry.
Oh my God, Ed.
I don't know. I start talking to you, Kenji, and my punometer goes off. All right.
Those are going to, yeah, they go right out of my ear. Like, those puns are just like a flash in the pan for me.
Oh, God. All right, man. We'll talk soon.
All right.
Thanks, Kenji. Kenji Lopez-Alt is SiriusXM's chief culinary consultant and author of The Food Lab. Do send in your questions to specialsauce@SiriusXM.com. And now it's time to hear more from Susan Spungen. Welcome back.
Thanks.
When we left, you were just about to start dishing up beef bourguignon on movie sets. So how did that happen? How did you go from successful freelancing to food styling on movies?
Well, I mean, I will tell you exactly how it started, but you know, the movies, because the sort of there's a quite an afterglow. It's not like that's all I was doing over those years, because I did a movie, then I did another movie. So, you know, three months at work here, 3 months at work there. But somehow the movies, they have like a lasting effect, which is kind of great for my career. So I was doing lots of other things during and, you know, between all of those movie jobs. But so one day, literally my phone rang. It wasn't an email. We had email, but it was actually Nora Ephron on the phone calling me, and I thought it was a friend playing a joke on me, because it's like, hi, this is Nora Ephron. I was thinking, you've got to be kidding me. Is this really Nora Ephron calling me? And she said, yes, well, I'm making a movie about Julia Child, and I asked, I think you might have been one of the people, but...
She did. She asked me after we had lunch, not that we were close friends, but we were acquaintances, and I was incredibly proud of that fact.
Right.
She used to come to Sirius Eats World Headquarters, actually, and do pastrami tastings.
Yeah, yeah, she was a maven.
Biscuit tastings, and she was just a fan.
Yeah, she was.
She was a fan of Sirius Eats. She was a fan of Ed Levine, and it was like... And for me, you know, Nora Ephron was one of my writing heroes.
Right.
You know, not just from her movie screenplays, but from those essays, you know, that she wrote. You know, she's awesome. Anyway.
So she said to me, I mean, I think she said it was Amanda Hester, but later I heard that you corroborated Amanda Hester's recommendation.
Because
she said, who should I get to do the food for my movie? And I think I'm quoting directly, because that is kind of the way she talked. And everybody said, you, so I'm calling you. And she literally said, who should do the food for my movie? And I just thought, you know, wow, I am so in for this. You know, it's like, why would I say no? It's just, I mean, again, I was, you know, going feet first into something I knew nothing about, but I knew that I could, especially at this point in my career, that I could figure it out.
Plus, it's the perfect intersection of what you started to do at the commissary and at food in combining your visual aesthetic. And now your cooking chops, which had developed over a number of years.
And this time also having to translate it, which is one of the things I think I'm good at, maybe because of my artist's eye of translating what would be really great on film, even though I hadn't done it before. But I was very good at, like, thinking about it. You know, it wasn't like I was just a cook and I had no idea, like, you know, what it was going to look like filmed. So I had a good sense of what would be cool on film. So, you know, I didn't get the job instantly, but I met with Nora. I met with, I think, the whole team that was already on board. And I did get hired as the culinary consultant / food stylist for the film. And so it was a fantastic experience. And it was like really like 3 months full time, which is not usually how it is on a film. They'll call you in for a few days here or there.
Right. But this is a real film about food.
Yeah.
Food was central to the movie.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we really had to be there like almost, which was good almost every day, because if they were trying, when they try to say, well, just come on Tuesday, things change all the time on film sets. So it's very hard. I've worked on other projects where they only wanted you on certain days and they're like, well, but it's going to snow tomorrow. So we're pulling up food. And it's like, but I'm working on something else tomorrow. So it's better on a situation like this where you're just there for 3 months. And, you know, I worked with an amazing prop person called Diana Burton. She also was instrumental in bringing me on. And, you know, she taught me a lot. I mean, and it was, you know, about working on a movie set. So it was really helpful to have her.
So it seems to me that the key to styling food on a movie set is how to account for time.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like
you make a beef bourguignon at 6 o'clock.
Right.
And then when it appears on set,
right,
it has to feel like it's coming out of the oven and it's bubbling and it looks perfect or not in the case.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? But, well, it seems to me the hardest thing is like how do you play with time when
right.
it comes to the
well,
food?
Well, in a funny way, that's kind of one of the big parts of my book, if we're going to, you know,
yeah,
is
sure.
like all of those things that I know about how far ahead you can make things, how you can hold them until it's time to serve, all of those things that I've learned through my professional experiences, like what you're talking about, is what guides the way I cook when I'm having people over, too. So it's like, you know, this part you can make, hey, 3 days ahead.
Yeah.
This part you can make 3 hours ahead.
And is that something you really mastered on movie sets, or had you already dealt with those issues?
Oh, yeah.
Magazine?
No, no. Between catering, catering is huge. You have to think about, you know, especially if it's a big party.
Right.
Well, you have to make almost as much as possible ahead, but there are some things you have to make there, like a salad or, you know, whipped cream or whatever it is. So, you know, those kind of things are second nature to most chefs. And then it's the same kind of things come into food styling, whether it's for a movie or for print, you know, because you have a lot to do. You have you cannot keep people waiting on a film set because you're not ready. With food.
That would not be appreciated.
I mean, it's bad on a photo shoot, but it's a lot worse on a film shoot because it's like every minute is thousands and thousands of dollars. So if anybody's waiting for you, you just don't want that. So
you
do everything you can to be ready, even if they say, oh, you know what? We're changing things around and we're going to pull you up right after lunch instead of like 5 o'clock like you thought, or you've worked all day to do this, but guess what? We ran out of time and you have to do it again tomorrow.
That's funny. So give us three tricks of the trade of food styling for movies.
For movies. Oh, boy. You know, the thing is, there aren't really tricks. I would say be prepared.
Be prepared doesn't count. Come on, Susan, man.
A trick?
We're going to edit it out.
But you mean like
prepared.
A very specific trick? Oh, boy.
You
should have prepared me for that one.
No, this can't be that hard. I'll take one.
All right. I'll give you one. I mean, the thing about tricks is every single job and every single food item presents its own challenges.
Mm-hmm.
So there aren't like sort of universal tricks that you use.
I believe
that. But we had one challenging scene where she had to pull Amy Adams had to, character, Julie had to pull a souffle out of the oven. Well, we all know how long a souffle lasts, right?
Seconds.
And, yeah. So a film crew, you know, waiting around and all of the other delays that happened, we knew it couldn't be a real souffle. So it turns out that pot au choux, a giant, giant thing of pot au choux.
Pot au choux is a pastry that people use. It's a French pastry.
For éclair, for gougère, for, you know, a lot of
cream puffs.
Yeah. And it's super, super sturdy. So, and it really looked exactly like a souffle.
Wow.
So if you ever, you know, we had that thing for weeks in the kitchen.
And did you have to think of that on the
spot?
Until
it got moldy.
Or had you thought about it?
Well, actually, Colin Flynn, who worked with me, I had to credit him. It was his idea. We were kind of trying to figure out how we were going to do it. And he was like, well, maybe pot au choux would work. And I was like, I think you're right. And so we just experimented with the right amount of pot au choux in the dish until it looked like a big billowy souffle. And, you know, for the purpose of film, you have to remember things are going by very, very quickly. You would never be like, hey, wait a minute, that's not a souffle, because it's pretty darn close to a souffle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, I was on that movie set.
And Dina DeLuca. I wasn't there that night.
I was in Dina DeLuca, and if you really watch the movie closely and you slow it down, you can see the back of my head. So it was my star turn.
I had a moment, too. Nora gave me a moment. Do you remember? There's a scene where someone's calling on the phone when she's getting a lot of calls. Julie Powell, after Amanda Husser, who also has a cameo, writes about her. And she, it's like, this is Ruth Spungen from Food and Wine.
That's awesome.
And that was, and Nora like wrote that into the script. That's like to give me a little nod.
You know, she was full of little touches that made you feel special, you know, and at least, you know, in everyone I've ever talked to about her.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure she was incredibly tough-minded.
I don't know if
she
was great.
Had to be,
yeah,
but,
absolutely.
You know, she was awesome.
She was great. And at one point, I had an email, and I think it's gone now because I don't have Earthlink anymore, but she had written me an email before she passed away, and it was soon after the movie came out, and she referred to it as our movie, as opposed to my movie, which is how she called it before we did it. But afterwards, she referred to it as our movie, and I just thought that really, like, showed how generous she was.
Yes, she used to introduce me as, this is Ed Levine, he's the best food writer in the world, you know, which was so not true, right? But it didn't matter. It was just, you know, it was just incredibly flattering.
Yeah.
So you're doing movies. Mm-hmm. You do Eat, Pray, Love, where you have to move to Rome.
Well, it was only 3 weeks.
3 weeks.
But it was a fun 3 weeks in Rome. Crazy, but yeah, it was fun to spend that much time in a place. And when you work in a place, it's very different than being a tourist. So,
and did you find, was it stressful or fun to work with people like Meryl Streep and Amy Adams and Julia Roberts?
Well, I mean, a little bit of both, and everybody's a little different. But I would say on Julie and Julia, it was, you know, very relaxed because we were on a soundstage in Brooklyn. Okay. That's very different than being on location in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were really in the streets in Rome. And so it was, you know, when you're on a stage, you get to hang out with the actors in a different way. Not that they're hanging out with you, but by It's Complicated, Meryl and I had developed a kind of nice relationship because we had already worked on a movie together. So there was a certain familiarity. And then on It's Complicated, she also had her sort of second dressing room, like right next to my little kitchen. So, you know, I'd say, oh, would you like a piece of salmon, Meryl? And she was real. She's great. She's wonderful. I loved working with her on both films. But with Julia Roberts, I mean, we were in Rome and they're like, they would get a hotel room for her next to wherever we were shooting, because you can't even have trailers. It's not the same kind of situation as New York, where there's all the trucks, and it was very, very scrappy shooting in Rome. So I didn't really have as much interaction with her. And plus, she wasn't cooking. Like on Julie and Julia, the actors were actually cooking. So I had to give them more instruction.
Got it. Did the food styling in the movies sort of change your life in any way that you expected, or was it really just another good-paying gig where you got to hang out with some famous people, and I'm sure it was stressful, but like, was it just another thing that you mastered, another skill?
No, I mean, it was more like just a really nice thing to have on my resume, and mm-hmm. and something I think that because of sort of the magic of movie making and people's sort of general like celebrity worship and feeling about Hollywood, that it's brought me a lot of recognition for that work, and that's been great. And they were great experiences to have had.
Yeah.
But, you know, honestly, in my career, you know, they were like weeks and months out of a very long career. So,
right.
So like I said, the effect of them is much bigger than, you know, the time they took to do or anything like that. But I've gotten some, you know, really nice press around each one of those movies and been part of promoting those movies, and
it's
fun.
And now that I'm talking to you, I'm realizing that I think it gets back to early on this combination of a visual aesthetic and food craft is still just as relevant today.
True.
In fact, it
more
may be more relevant.
Right.
And actually, the visual aesthetic may be more important than the craft at this particular moment.
True.
So, you know, with all the Instagram stuff going on and how photo-heavy the food media world is.
And if I may say something about that, I feel like, you know, the Instagram, when that became a thing, or, you know, how long have I been doing it? I don't know, since like 2012 or something like that. And I realized, wow, this is like a visual outlet for me. So I was able to sort of bring my own personal artistic sense back into, have some kind of place to put it.
Yeah,
which
absolutely.
Has been really kind of cool for me.
Yeah,
because it's like, you know, a frustrated artist. Like, I do things sometimes and put it on Instagram and people are like, oh my God, it's so artistic. And I'm like, oh, I didn't even, even thinking about that.
Yeah,
you know?
Because it's been your jam for 25 years.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's weird.
Yeah.
So the New York Times ended up calling you the Babe Ruth
booth of cookies.
I know,
and as a baseball fan, I appreciated that. You know, I was like, wow, Susan's like the Babe Ruth.
Which means what? I hit home runs every time?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I was like, wait a minute, I haven't really thought that much about what that actually meant.
It also means that you drank a lot before work, you know, no. I mean,
now no, I'm stuck with that.
It means that you were the superstar,
right?
Of cookies, like.
Well,
Babe
I think
Ruth
when it was used in the context of again, who should we get to do this for us? And they were like, "Who's the Babe Ruth of cookies?" That's what the you know. And then somebody was like, "Susan is the Babe Ruth of cookies," because they were like, "Who can hit it out of the park?" That was kind of what they were looking for. So,
what was your gig for the Times?
What was my gig?
Yeah, like what were you doing for the Times where they were
need
the Babe Ruth of cookies?
Oh, no, they, you know, they published this big cookie feature in the Sunday Times in the, you know, the print edition. I mean, it sort of started with the print edition and then all the social stuff just kind of comes with it.
Right.
But it's like a couple times a year they do this, you know, big elaborate saloon door, they call it, the way the paper opens, 8-page spread and on cookies. So that was like the beginning of it. And they were like, want to do 12 dazzling recipes. Those are the words that Emily Weinstein said to me. And I was like, all right, I'm going to dazzle them. So, you know, that was how it started. They said, do you want to do this project? And I was like, again, what do I always say? Absolutely. Yes, I'm in. So I took that on and it was a really, really, really fun thing to do.
And because you knew so little about baseball, you didn't really feel the added pressure from
that
the
wasn't
Babe
until
Ruth
later.
Thing.
That the Babe Ruth thing didn't come out until the whole thing was
Got
done.
It. All right.
Yeah, I
All
didn't
right.
know that was happening.
I mean, if I may make a bad pun, you were the cookie monster of recipe developers. All right, all right, all right. I'll move on. So let's turn the page.
That was bad, Ed.
And talk about your new book,
yes,
Open Kitchen.
That's why I'm here.
Yeah, that's why you're here. How did you come to write it, Open Kitchen?
Yeah.
What was the jumping off point? Like, and do you need a big idea when you're thinking about books?
That's a tough thing, you know, because
I ask tough questions.
Yeah, no. I'm just saying it's something you ask yourself a lot because I think – sometimes your agent will tell you it's a big idea, but in some ways I think it's more like it's a small idea. It's more like a hook or a conceit, that I think. Mm-hmm. I mean,
sure.
I'll get back to you about how this book does, but I think it has to have something that is a point of view.
Right.
And I don't think it has to be like, wow, no one has ever written a book about this before. Because come on, like everything's been done, and especially if you go back through, you know, the history
of cookbooks.
Yeah. I mean, there's always going to be a new angle. And, you know, before there was keto, there were no keto books, but that's a different story.
There were Atkins books.
Yeah. So I think it's really more that you need to have an organizing principle that makes sense to you and to the reader.
So you talked about this Italian word.
Yeah.
Sprezzatura.
Sprezzatura.
And which means studied nonchalance, according to your book.
Right.
And that almost became the organizing principle.
It was, really, yes. And it is one of the first words in my intro. So, and, you know, at one point, when we were shopping around the proposal, somebody wanted that to be the title of the book. And I had to kind of rework my proposal. But then we didn't end up going with that publisher. And I think maybe, and then other people were like, no, that would be a really big mistake, having an Italian word and whatever. It probably would have made people think it was an
Italian cookbook.
Which it's not, even though I do a lot of, I default to Italian cooking much of the time. It's not all I do, and it's certainly not an Italian cookbook. But sprezzatura means studied nonchalance. So, and it's usually a term that is used to describe like men's fashion, when like a guy who's just sort of like looks amazing, has gorgeous clothes on, but just looks like he's not trying too hard. You.
Oh my God.
So it really is like that, you know, just your hair is a little undone, you know, you just look perfect, but you don't look like you're trying too hard. So that's kind of like what I sort of go for with food.
With food.
Yeah.
And you talk about in the introduction about the appearance of effortlessness. The appearance of effortlessness.
right.
And that's a very, which is a sort of first cousin of sprezzatura.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And it sort of does permeate the book.
Yeah, I think it does. Yeah. So, you know, that I think that appearance of effortlessness comes from this whole idea of being prepared. And you know, I like to do that because I'm a planner, and B, I like to be really ready when people come over. I'm not that person that is going to be slaving away in the kitchen and with a sink full of pots when guests right. come over. I just really, I like to be, I you know, and it's so hackneyed. People have said it a million times. So you can enjoy the party and sit right. with your guests. But that really is my goal. Mm-hmm. And I usually achieve it.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting about the book is you don't stress the ease of anything,
right.
even though you try to make things as easy as
yes,
possible.
True.
I love the last two paragraphs of the introduction. I'm not going to lie. Good food does take some planning and work. I don't want to make promises of effortlessness. I just want to help you get closer to that mm-hmm. and to the experience of effortlessness. And to the appearance of effortlessness,
right.
excuse me. But it's pleasure that fuels the work, going to the farmer's market, going to the fish market to see what looks good, being creative in the kitchen. All these joyful things happen while you are making this effort.
Mm-hmm.
Cooking is how you learn to be a good cook.
Yeah.
Just like anything else, cooking is a practice. So as you keep cooking, you'll find yourself getting more and more comfortable and better at it. You won't get better at cooking just by reading this book. You need to get yourself into the kitchen and cook without the fear of failure, because there really is no such thing. You know, that's pretty good, you know? Yeah.
That's truly, truly what I believe. And actually, that was a little part of that. One of the things I love about an iPhone is notes. You know, I actually wrote some of that when I was taking a walk out in the beautiful sunshine. And I was like, you know, that, like, this whole idea of, like, you know, effort. I mean, people, it's like, don't cook if you don't enjoy it, you know?
Yeah.
Because it comes through in your food. You have yeah. to love it. You want to have a good time doing it.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can't think about, well, it's so much work, you know. I mean, it's like you have to be willing to do a little work.
I'm not, you know? And it's true. And for me, it's when I have time, like in the mm-hmm. summer or when I have an entire Saturday, mm-hmm. I love it. I'm not
yeah.
one of these people that cooks for therapeutic right. reasons during the week.
Right.
In other words, if I come home, I'm not going to want, I don't want feigned effortlessness. I actually want effortlessness.
Right, right, right.
You know, it's like, but, you know, in the book you talk about cooking in stages, mm-hmm. what you can make ahead and what you mm-hmm. can't. You mm-hmm. talk about multi-steps. And mm-hmm. if you actually read the book and take it to heart, I think you will have a better time in the kitchen.
That's my hope.
Yeah.
That's my hope.
How has your cooking and thinking evolved over the years where you got to this point?
Yeah, so much. I mean, sometimes I look back at earlier recipes I wrote and, you know, like I say, cooking is how you learn to cook. So, I mean, I have just gotten so much better. I mean, like anything else, it's trial and error. So when you have done things so many times, you have a much better sense of what's going to happen. So I guess my cooking... I've learned, because the technique part is more second nature, how to really, like, build flavors. I feel like that's one of the things that you can't see in the pictures, but that really are a big part of my recipes, is how good they taste
yeah.
and how well they come out and how, you know, people will be like, wow, that was, like, really good,
yeah.
you know. And also the talent of translating what you cook into the kitchen into a recipe that someone at home can use. That
right.
is a talent all unto itself.
Right, because not all those people are going to have the same level of craft that you do to
right.
build flavors.
Right, right. So, but being able to... I mean, that's the biggest challenge of being a food writer, and when I mean food writer, I mean recipe writer, is just... making it possible for someone to duplicate the experience that you've had in the kitchen. That's the biggest challenge. And, you know, a lot of recipes or books can miss the mark if they're not experienced. They're like, yeah, I'm going to write a cookbook. Or they have a co-writer. And, you know, there's not that a strong connection between the person who did that cooking and the person writing the recipe.
Sure.
So
I loved how you talk in the book about the pantry, where you say pantry is palate, because it's a way that you truly bring your mm-hmm. your art world.
Yeah, it's true. It's
true.
And
your food world.
I did do that, yeah.
Is that on purpose?
Yeah, well, yeah, because that's how I think of it. It's like a palette. It's like where you, you know, like your palette of colors. It's, you got to have that, and you can't really make a painting without paint, right?
So give us three recipes people should start with in the book and tell us why you've chose them.
Again, you should have prepped me for that one.
Come on, man.
Can I see the book?
Yeah, of course you can.
Well, I'm off the top of my head, I'm going to say the banana bread because it's, I think anyone can make a banana bread.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really good banana bread.
Right, but it's an unusual banana bread. It's not your everyday banana bread, if I remember.
It's true. It has buckwheat flour.
Right.
And it also has toasted buckwheat groats on the top for crunch. And it has a delicious glaze with tahini and maple, and it's yummy.
Yeah.
And don't sleep on the glaze because the glaze is really good. And if you don't,
I'm not sleeping on the glaze.
And if you don't do the glaze, then you will have nothing for the buckwheat to stick to. So you don't want to do that. And then so another favorite that's really quite easy and accessible would be this not fried eggplant parm, which has. These big croutons, the eggplant is just roasted. It's not fried. It's not breaded. You don't do any of that fussy stuff. And it has bread which absorbs all the juices from the tomatoes and the eggplant.
And fresh basil.
Delicious. And burrata at the end. I mean, how can you go wrong with that? All right. Are we looking for entry level things here?
Yeah. Well, it doesn't matter. Just
any of the toasts are a great way in. But I'm going to give you one more really good one. Want to bake?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, those were two baking ones, but whole grain cumin cracker bread. These are not just delicious but gorgeous.
Got it.
They're easy. They're like a big cracker. I've always been a fan of homemade crackers, and there's a few in the book.
Got it.
Yeah.
Cool.
Those are three easy things.
Yeah, I like that.
And there's so much more, but...
What's next?
Well, I'm promoting this book.
Yeah, I understand.
What's next? I'm not sure. Yeah. Actually, I'm working on a documentary about Julia Child.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, with the ladies who did RGB.
Oh, yeah. In fact...
I mean RBG. I always say it wrong.
I know her. Is it Betsy?
Yeah.
And
Julie.
And Betsy's husband.
Yeah.
Oren, who is also a great documentarian.
Yeah.
He's in my movie group. I have a movie group. All right, so now it's time for the special sauce all-you-can-answer buffet. And I know you're going to tell me I should have prepped you, but tough.
Is this a speed round?
Because it's edited, you don't have to worry about the speed.
Okay.
So who's at your last supper?
Oh.
No family allowed.
Okay.
Right? I know.
I wouldn't allow family.
Well, you love – I know you love your husband.
Yes.
He's a cool
guy. Family. Yeah,
yeah,
he's family. Oh, boy.
And it can be artists. It can be musicians. It can be people living
All right, I've
dead.
Got
–
Actually,
Doesn't
they
matter.
Would be artists. And
okay.
off the top of my head, I'm going to say Donald Judd and Georgia O'Keeffe because they both love food and cooking. And I've been in both of their kitchens.
Really?
By touring in Marfa and New York and Donald Judd's homes.
Yeah, and Donald Judd is still alive, right?
No,
he died a few years ago.
Quite a few years.
Yeah,
and Georgia.
That's how I know you're getting old is when you say to someone, "Oh, they just died or they're alive." It's like, no, they died.
And Georgia O'Keeffe, her recipe box is up on the auction block, and I was recently toured her house in Abiquiu, New Mexico.
Uh huh.
And seeing her kitchen and her garden, I just. You know, but I even though I would have loved to sit at their table, I'd like to have them at my table
too. All right. Any non-artist?
Like oh, non-artist.
One
more person.
Or two more people, you know, it's like.
My last supper?
Yeah.
You really should have prepped me.
Come on. We've had people.
So someone I've never met would be probably really more where you're going, right?
Yeah.
Well, all right, Mick Jagger.
That's good. Mick Jagger.
Because I finally saw the Stones this summer and we had really good seats and just, I don't know, just feeling
You'd
his
never
energy.
Never seen the Stones before?
Never. So it's seeing his energy
You know,
up close.
My friend, I have a friend who used to say, the Stones these days, they're the best Stones cover band in the world.
Absolutely. I heard that. Yes, and they are. They're really good.
All right. Well, that's good. So it's that's an interesting trio.
It's true. It would see. That's the kind of dinner party I like to put together. You know.
So, what are you eating?
What do I eat?
Yeah. What are you eating at the last supper?
Well, I'm eating really healthy right now because I'm trying to look okay for
but
my.
It's your last supper. So you don't have to.
Oh,
worry
oh, at
about
this
that.
Meal.
Yeah.
At this meal. Oh boy. Well, it would have to be probably some kind of large communal dish, I don't know if I would do meat because, you know, someone might be a vegetarian. That's always how
don't
I
Don't worry about that.
All right. Well, I'd probably do like maybe the lamb that's in my book with the pomegranate molasses.
I like that.
Lamb shoulder, which I sort of, I mean, lamb shoulder's a little hard to get. You got to really special order it, but it's really a great cut.
Yeah,
and
because,
delicious.
Well, people have it, right? Because they sell shoulder chops. It's just they don't sell
right,
the whole
exactly.
shoulder.
So you have to order it, but it's really a great cut. It's just like doing a pork shoulder, but smaller. You know, if you have a lot of people, you do two of them.
Right.
That's like a great. You can just sort of pull out it and some other dishes. Yeah.
And side dishes, dessert?
Yeah, well, I'm going to give you stuff from the book because that's what's... So with the lamb, I have this, a frique salad.
Okay.
It's got pickled onions in it.
Frique is a grain.
Yeah. It's like green wheat, smoked green wheat. So good. I mean, you could use tabbouleh if you didn't have frique, but I love the smokiness of the frique and that pomegranate seeds. And I think that... Georgia O'Keeffe and Donald Judd and even Mick
would
Jagger
appreciate
would appreciate that.
And what about for dessert?
Oh, dessert. What time of year is it?
Oh, God. Don't
All right.
Those questions.
I'd probably just do a galette.
Okay.
You know,
like
one
an
of
apple
my,
galette.
Yeah, apple or peach. I have in the, yeah.
That's good. And what are you listening to? And don't try to, you know, like
Leonard
kiss
Cohen.
Miss Jagger, Mick Jagger.
No. Leonard Cohen radio on Pandora.
I love that. Leonard Cohen radio on Pandora. All right.
It's really a good Pandora station. You can listen to it for hours.
So what are three books, they can be cookbooks or not, that have influenced your life?
Ed, this is not fair. You should have prepped me.
Go ahead.
Well, okay, the New York Times cookbook.
Okay.
The old one.
The old one.
Yeah, Craig Claiborne. I already told you how it influenced me.
Okay.
So, I mean, I guess recently I listened to The Handmaid's Tale again, even though I probably had read it, and... sort of obsessed with Margaret Atwood.
Got it.
Always
All right.
Because I think she's amazing. But some of the early, you know what's kind of, I'm going to say Cucina Fresca. Do you remember
really?
That book?
Sure.
Yeah. That was, because I was thinking about that recently.
That was, what's
Yana
her name?
LaPlace and,
yeah,
Plas
Yana
and,
LaPlace.
And Evan Kleinman, who does radio now.
Right.
But that book was really influential on me because it sort of showed how you could be simple.
Yeah.
Everything didn't have to be fussy and fancy.
Sure.
And it was just like a kind of Italian cooking that I really, really related to. And it was at a sort of formative time in my career.
Got it.
Yeah.
Three things in your kitchen that you can't do without.
Oh, okay. That's easy. My Kyocera mandolin.
Okay.
Yeah. I use it all the time. And,
with gloves or without?
With gloves.
Okay.
I highly recommend gloves.
All right.
Actually, one of the things I use all the time that I love is a sieve from Muji, which has little feet on it. And, you know, it's big enough to drain pasta in for a couple people, but it's, you know, clean mushroom, everything. I just use it constantly.
Got it.
Because I don't like colanders. They don't have enough holes.
Okay.
And what else can I not? Well, knives, of course.
Right.
Good knives. All right, you're not counting that. So, and yes, a bench scraper. I use a bench scraper. I should have turned to my tools page. But yeah, a bench scraper because I use it all the time for many, many things, for making gnocchi, for transferring onions to a saute pan.
Sweet and savory, yeah.
Yeah, I have it on the counter almost all the time.
Got
and
it.
Use it all the time.
What do you cook when there's nothing in the house to eat?
Well, usually pasta, because there's usually some pasta.
All right,
and even if you only had pasta and butter and capers, you'd have a meal, right?
That's it. That's one of the things that I do, actually.
Yeah.
I love that. So it's just been declared Susan Spungen Day all over the world.
Oh, my God.
What's happening on that day?
Oh, my God. Everybody's dropping out of school.
Everyone's dropping out of school? It's an unusual answer.
I don't know. I don't know, Ed. What's everyone doing on Susan Spungen Day? Cooking. Baking. Having fun in the kitchen.
But with sprezzatura.
Yeah.
Okay, so they're cooking and making it seem effortless.
Yeah.
All right.
Having people over.
All right, that's good. Yeah. Anyway, thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, Susan Spungen. If you want to know how to set up a serious spread to your guests without stressing, pick up a copy of Susan's new book, Open Kitchen, Inspired Food for Casual Gathering.
Thanks for having me, Ed.
That's it for this week's episode of Special Sauce. Please stay safe and healthy, serious eaters. And I hope all this pandemic food talk reminds you that we should do everything we can at this perilous moment to support both local restaurants and the farmers and purveyors that supply them. So long, serious eaters. We'll see you next time.